From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Happy birthday to Barb in Toronto from your hubby, William. Later tonight, the magic of sound. Here's what's happening. Iran has unveiled a new missile with a reported range that would allow it to reach both U.S. bases in that region as well as targets inside of Israel. Their state TV reported that the missile uses solid fuel, has a range of 900 miles. Truckers opposed to coronavirus mandates risk hurting the auto sector and agriculture as they block U.S.-Canadian border crossings. This, according to the White House, as Ford Motor Company halted some output and Ottawa urged an end to the 13-day-long protests. Many pandemic-weary Western countries will soon mark 2 years of restrictions as copycat protests spreading now to Australia, New Zealand, France, and now the highly infectious Omicron variant begins to ease in some places. Horn-blaring protests have been causing gridlock in the capital of Ottawa, Canadian capital, since late January. And from Monday night, truckers shut the inbound Canadian traffic at the Ambassador Bridge in Detroit, a supply route for Detroit's car makers and agricultural products. The truckers are upset over mandates in Canada. Vaccines. The U.S. is exiting the full-blown pandemic phase of the year-long COVID-19 crisis that began in 2020, according to the Biden administration's chief medical advisor, Anthony Fauci. Fauci, who's the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, says that new developments that limit COVID-19 include vaccinations, medical treatments, and prior infection will alter the pandemic significantly in the coming months. The family of Bob Saget says the comedian died of head trauma a month ago in his Florida hotel room. A statement from Saget's family shared the conclusion from the medical examiner's office investigating his death. Apparently, he hit his head, went to bed, just never woke up. Switching to a healthier diet of nuts, beans, and whole grains as a young adult can help you live a decade longer, according to a new study on longevity. A team from the University of Bergen says that healthy diet changes actually benefit people of all ages, but the earlier someone moves away from red and processed meat, the better it is in the long run. Now, if you live in Canada, be careful from a soda. It's called the Lemon and Ginger Sicilian Soda, made by a company called Loblaw Companies. They've got glass in it, and they've issued a recall. Let's check in with food safety coach Jeff Nelkin. Jeff, how does glass get in soda, for crying out loud?
Well, that's going to be the million-dollar question. It could be anything from the bottles when they were delivered and, you know, they got banged up, to possible use of glass, you know, in the production area. Could have been the cover of a watch from somebody that was wearing a watch in the workplace. So they're going to have to do an investigation. If anybody has that product, you know, the consumer hotline for the Loblaw company is 800-442-2342. You can give them a call and verify if you have that product in your home.
Most companies will issue voluntary recalls when it comes to food, won't they?
Correct.
Well, that's a good thing. Thanks, Jeff. Jeff Nelkin, foodsafetycoach.com. Facebook owner Meta Platforms is struggling to help stop counterfeiters from pushing fake luxury goods from Gucci to Chanel across its social media apps, according to the research. Its platforms have emerged as hotspots for counterfeit offenders who exploit their range of social and private messaging tools to reach users. Let's check in with registered investment advisor Mish Sunak. And people are actually buying these goods, Mish?
Yeah, it seems like it, George. Facebook's troubles keep going on and on and on. About a week ago, share price plunged 25% in a day. A lot of that was tied to security that Apple put on that impacted Facebook. Facebook knew that this was coming, though, and I think it's trying to branch out into other areas. You know, mainly retail sales here. Ghost Data, it's a social media analytics firm, identified 26,000 1,000 active counterfeit accounts on Facebook. That was an October 21, 2021 study, and they found another 20,000 on Instagram, which is a company that Facebook bought up. So these woes just keep going on and on. And I'm looking at Facebook here. It hit an all-time high last September of about $384 a share. It plunged from roughly 328 down to 220, a 25% plunge in a day. It lost $200 billion in market cap in a single day. That's more than the valuation of 90% of the company
Yes.
on the S&P 500. The woes just keep on mounting here. I don't think good news is ahead. We'll just have to watch this and see. I think a bigger plunge in Facebook is still ahead because younger people are giving up Facebook in droves. It's
running to TikTok,
boomers and millennials, on Facebook. Zoomers don't seem to want anything to do with it, George.
Interesting take. Thanks, Mish. We'll talk to you next week. You know, we've been talking about solar flares from the sun for years. Listen to this one. A geomagnetic storm triggered by a large burst of radiation from the sun has disabled at least 40 of the 49 satellites newly launched by SpaceX as part of its Starlink Internet communications network. The incident was believed to mark the largest collective loss of satellites stemming from a single geomagnetic event and was unique in the way it unfolded. Well, we've been warning for years now, haven't we? Up next, Nick Redfern joins us. We're going to talk about the Men in Black and time travel on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie here. Nick Redfern, our special guest. Nick has been interested in UFOs since 1978. His main area of research centers around determining what has been learned about the UFO subject at an official level in Britain. He has spent hundreds of hours at the Public Record Office in London and has uncovered thousands of pages of previously classified Royal Air Force, Air Ministry, and Ministry of Defense files on UFOs. He's got a couple books out, including Men in Black, Time Travel, which we'll talk about both of these. Nick, welcome back. How are you, sir?
Hey, George. I'm good. Thanks.
Always good to hear your voice. Always good. And
good.
COVID-free, my friend?
I'm sorry?
Are you COVID-free?
Oh, yes. Yes, I'm good and healthy. Yeah, no problems.
Great. Men in Black. Tommy Lee Jones, Will Smith started that movie. The world then began to know about Men in Black. But actually, what are they, and when did this start, Nick? Mm.
Well, that's a good question, because I think most people, certainly the general public, didn't really know anything about the Men in Black at all, until the 90s when the movies came out. And everybody then had heard of the Men in Black. But what's particularly intriguing is that in the movies, the Men in Black are portrayed as secret agents of a secret agency fighting aliens. But the reality is very different. If you look back into the history of ufology, the Men in Black, the real ones, not the Hollywood ones, the real ones first surfaced in the latter part of the 1940s through into the early 1950s. And the one person who kicked all this off was a guy named Albert Bender, who lived in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and he created a UFO research organization called the International Flying Saucer Bureau. And he was visited and threatened by a trio of men in black who warned him to leave the UFO subject alone. Now, what's particularly intriguing about all these cases from the 1950s and people like Bender who were threatened and said, you will not talk about this, all the people, the witnesses or the victims, however you want to term them, they described the men in black not looking entirely human. Now, that sounds a little bit strange, but most of the witnesses described them having skin that sort of looks almost like wax or plastic.
Kind of pasty looking.
Huh? Yeah, and very sort of scrawny and gaunt, and but also having these bulging eyes. And that was one of the primary reasons as to why they wore these wraparound sunglasses. And some witnesses have suggested, you know, could they actually be aliens in disguise? And which sounds a little bit strange, but as I said, the vast majority, when you get rid of Hollywood and so on, that is what the witnesses actually talk about. Most of them do not talk about, you know, guys in the FBI looking like that. You know, they do sort of really look very, very strange, and they come across, as I said, you know, in a fashion that really makes you think either they're extraterrestrial, or as some people like Albert Bender came to believe, that they were more sort of occult or supernatural rather than definitively extraterrestrial.
And Nick, they didn't have any personality. They were just straight, arrowed people, and they showed minimal emotion, right?
Yeah, they wouldn't be much good at a party, really.
No, you wouldn't want to sit in a corner and get stuck with one.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, you're right. They have this sort of, the face, the way they work, the whole thing. It really is as if they have sort of no, mind. What's particularly intriguing, mostly, is that it sounds like from a lot of the witnesses that the men in black are actually sort of making statements and threats, but they don't actually know what they're saying. It's almost as if it's like a loop, and they're like the, you know, sort of like a robot-type situation, and they actually don't know what they're talking about because they are possibly something along those lines. And it does sound strange. However, many witnesses have said that they got this view or this feeling that whatever the men in black were talking about, they didn't know what they're saying. They were saying it in sort of a parrot fashion. And again, this puts the whole phenomenon into sort of very different system, far away from Hollywood. And again, if you put that angle in as well, you know, this sort of non-emotion angle, we get to see a picture of the men in black, which is really different and diverse from what many people have come to learn, you know.
Any witnesses report how they left when they finally departed the house or wherever they confronted the human beings? How did they depart?
Well, actually, that's a really good point, George, because, you know, it's the same thing with sort of letting them in and letting them out. It's almost as if the witnesses have been hypnotized because, you know, if you've got, say, this skinny trio of men in black knocking on your front door at 9 o'clock, you probably wouldn't let them in, you know.
No.
And it's the same with vice versa. You know, if when the men in black have given their threat and then they leave, you might think, I'm going to go after them. But people don't do that either. And this has given rise to the possibility of some degree of mind control to the point where, you know, their minds are being controlled and the witnesses themselves are just sort of sitting in the chair almost in a stunned situation. And a lot of them have said that it was usually round about sort of 10 to 15 minutes afterwards the person starts to wake up. You know, it's almost like in a situation in a hospital, you know.
Like they're in a daze.
Yeah, you're sort of dazed and not really knowing what's going on. And then about 15 minutes later, everything goes back to normal. But, of course, by that time, the men in black are long gone. So there's a lot of weird stuff that a lot of people don't know when it comes to the history of the BMIB.
And nobody remembers how they left, whether they got in a car or somebody picked them up or they just merely disappeared?
Oh, well, that's another weird thing with the cars. I mean, even today, the men in black, and they still look the same today, I should stress, you know, and they wear...
So, and it's still happening then?
Yes, and they still wear the old-style fedora hats and trench coats. And they also drive in what are usually old-style black Cadillacs. And but in many of the cases, and this is going to sound really weird, most of the witnesses who've seen the cars have said that the cars have literally vanished in front of them, or possibly it was sort of like a hologram. And there's so many cases that fall into that category of sort of, you know, the car sort of melting away. And who they are or what they are, and, you know, whether they are extraterrestrials, occult, paranormal, all of these aspects can be thrown into the MIB situation, if you like.
Were there ever any reports of women as these agents?
Oh, yes. I wrote a full-length book on the women in black. It's got the title of Women in Black. And, that's one of the lesser-known aspects of this subject. But I would say I've written five books now on the men in black, four on the men in black and one on the women in black. And when I started to write my first first book on the Men in Black, what I found was, I would say probably out of every 15, 16 cases, one would be a woman in black. And they look exactly the same, with the very pale skin, gaunt cheek.
No personality.
No personality. Explosive eyes. I would say that in the sense, because they're huge, and most of the women in black, they wear these not just sunglasses but wraparound glasses, kind of like a skier would wear on the slope.
So they don't fall off. Yeah.
Yeah, and so the women in black aspect, but it's very much identical to the men in black. They typically knock on people's doors and they make the threat. You know, you won't talk about the UFO you saw. You won't talk about this and that. You won't talk about this. And so, in other words, their modus operandi, if you like, is exactly the same as the men in black.
And they always come to people who have witnessed the UFO sighting?
Yes. Well, it isn't just tied to people who've seen UFOs. Now, I should stress that the most people who get the threats are people who've had a close encounter of some kind, whether it's a sighting or you've had an alien abduction situation, something along those lines. However, I've got some cases where people were visited by the men in black and women in black when they've been dabbling in crop circles, and also in relation to Bigfoot. There are several cases, not many, but there are several cases relative to Bigfoot where people had seen some of these creatures and they had been visited and told not to talk about it as well, which takes things down, you know, a really even more bizarre situation. But when you also kind of, as I said, put the crop circles in the equation as well, it really makes you wonder if they are a kind of almost like an interplanetary sort of police force that really sort of doesn't just deal with UFOs, but with the paranormal aspects of cryptozoology, and it really expands in some really strange areas.
And Nick, how soon do they show up at your doorstep after the sighting or the episode?
How do they say that again? Sorry.
How soon do they show up?
Oh, well, that's an important question. I'll tell you for why. Because sometimes if a person's had a sighting or an encounter, the MIB are on the scene almost impossibly quick. And that happens in so many cases.
Hold on for a second, Nick. We're at a break. We'll come back and talk more about the Men in Black, and then we'll talk about time travel next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Nick Redfern. We're going to take your calls with Nick next hour here on Coast to Coast. And Nick, before we move into time travel, again, we were talking about how quickly, how soon the Men in Black get on the scene after somebody has either witnessed a UFO or an abduction case or something. And you say it's pretty quick.
Oh, yeah. It's almost impossibly quick. You know, somebody have seen something in the sky, and then maybe 5 minutes later, there's this slow, heavy bang on the door. The person goes to the door, and there's a man in black or a woman in black already there. And as I said, that's the one of the key issues that are really, really strange. And some researchers have suggested possibly that they're sort of materialized right in front of the front door.
That's interesting.
So to speak, rather than having sort of driven there or walked or whatever. So, you know, we've got a really weird situation when you put all of these different aspects of the MIB phenomenon, you put it all together, and you've got something that's totally far away from Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones.
How do they know who these people are to show up at their doorstep?
Well, again, that's one of the big anomalies. You know, there's it's almost as if the MIB themselves are fully aware of what happened and where it happened and have the ability to get there almost impossibly fast, yeah.
All right, let's talk a little bit about time travel. We're going to take calls with you next hour as well. You wrote a book called Time Travel, The Science and Science Fiction. And so you're into time travel, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. But I wrote my new book, Time Travel, a little bit different because what I didn't want to do was to, you know, go over all the old cases and, you know, black holes and things like this, where we've heard a lot of this kind of stuff before. And it's good material, but I wanted to try and open up a little bit further. Like, for example, one of the things I have a chapter in one of the book is one entire chapter subjected to deja vu. Now, I think everybody at some point has had deja vu, you know, this feeling that you're playing over something that happened perhaps 2 years ago, 3 years ago, but you got this really eerie and weird feeling that you're going through this loop of something that happened 3 years ago. And my view is kind of like with the old phrase now, with the Matrix, you know, there's a glitch in the Matrix. And I think having looked at deja vu just about as much as I can, I do really think that it is an aspect of the regular, the normal time zone, if you like, or the time approach to everything. What I think is that from now and again, there really are time glitches on our planet, and it's not. And I don't believe deja vu is just a glitch in the mind or anything like that at all. I think there really is a glitch in time. Now, how that can happen, well, you know, we don't know the answer to that question. However, it is one of these things, I think, that happens at random. And that's one of the things I've found, is that most witnesses who've said they've had time travel type experiences, they're not flying around in time machines or anything like this. They're having an event which they had no understanding of how it happened, and then perhaps after about 20 minutes later, the phenomenon goes away. And so I think deja vu is certainly one of the classic aspects that demonstrates how there really can be twists in time, if you like.
And I've always thought deja vu might also include another dimension that we are in, and we somehow, you know, remember it in pieces of it as deja vu. It's a very strange phenomenon, isn't it?
It is, you're right, yeah. It's now, almost like you don't have control of your life, because that's part of it has already gone through, you know.
How do we know that some of these ET craft that people have witnessed aren't time travelers, us, coming back from the future?
Well, that's actually a very good question, because, again, I've got a full, actually several chapters in the book that cover the idea that perhaps what if the UFO phenomenon is not extraterrestrial or interdimensional? What if it's actually time travel based? I mean, to give you an example, the famous Rendlesham Forest UFO landing in England in December 1980.
Great case.
One of the guys who was involved, one of the Air Force guys, was Jim Peniston.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim said that when he was having sort of, a back-to-forth, a conversation with the entities, he was told that it was not an alien landing. It was a time travel landing that's basically... supposedly, in the future, far in the future, our planet is supposedly in a very bad state. And so they come back to our present, where possibly things like cells, eggs, things like this, to try and upgrade our civilization again. And it's a fascinating story that Jim has told. And that would be, again, that would be a fascinating story if, after all these years, you know, we're looking for extraterrestrials, we might be actually seeing our future people, so to speak. And there's a very similar story as well in relation to Roswell. I'm sure you remember, George, 1997, when Colonel Corso's book, The Day After Roswell,
right,
was released.
The one he wrote with Bill Burns, that's right.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and it was the 50th anniversary of the Roswell event, 1997. The event was 1947. And Corso said that, from what he found out, that the Roswell aliens were not aliens, but they were biological robots designed to essentially pilot these craft. But kind of like the Men in Black, but doing it in parrot fashion. They were sort of, you know, given a program that they had to go along with. So, you know, that's two of the most famous cases, Roswell and Rendlesham, that various people have suggested that there might be a time travel aspect to this.
Do you think time travel indeed, Nick, is feasible?
Well, that's the big question, because, you know, like in the movies, you know, they've always got these flash time machines, you know, and really, you know, they like aircraft or spacecraft or anything like that. However, if you look at the history of time travel, there are very, very few examples of people saying they've actually built a time machine. What's actually being said is kind of like these glitches, these sudden changes in the atmosphere, and suddenly everywhere looks different. You know, it looks like a 50-year-old street now is like 200-year-old street, this kind of thing. But then suddenly it all comes back to normal. So, in other words, this angle of, you know, time machines and DeLoreans and all that kind of stuff, you know, if you look at it logically and deeply, there actually aren't many stories, good stories, of people going out there into if you like, the void, and finding ways to travel through time. We primarily, you know, we just have to go with the, you know, the claims of the witnesses. Now, one of the most famous people, not too long ago, 20 years ago, there was there was John Tider, and he was one of the most famous and controversial alleged time traveler who popped up in the early 2000s.
That's right. He came back from 2036, I believe, right?
Yeah, 2036. And he came back and made all these statements about what was going to happen in our early future, if you like. He was talking about civil wars, nuclear wars, and everything that was just bad, you know. And there's no doubt that, he sort of really broke this angle of time travel in the modern era. And he developed a huge coverage and numerous people who followed him all over the place. And but there were some, you know, there's some aspects of the story which were controversial, because some of the claims that he made did not work out. You know, for example, he never predicted, like, 9/11, one of the worst things that ever happened in U.S. history, you know. But his, some of his followers then said, well, the reason why he didn't get that one right was because it actually happened in sort of like a multiverse or a parallel world, rather than it happening in our world, that kind of situation. So, you know, when it comes, there's no doubt that when it comes to time travel witnesses, we really only do have, you know, the testimony. We don't have, you know, a time machine that we can go and see and then see the guy vanish and then come back, et cetera, et cetera. That has never, ever been achieved, you know.
I, of course, in 1895, H.G. Wells wrote his book, The Time Machine, which is amazing considering the year he wrote it, 1895. Then it was converted into that movie, 1960, with Rod Taylor, which I still think is one of the greatest time machine movies of all time.
Yeah, well, the girl who played the main human, she just died a couple of weeks ago. And you remember the
was that Yvette Mimou or something?
Yes, yeah, she just died a couple of weeks ago.
I didn't
ago.
Know that.
Yeah,
that's a shame.
And but yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, the time machine for a book to be written that long back and containing so many aspects of time travel which are still relevant today, you know, that was incredible. It just shows how, you know, H.G. Wells, how, you know, how good he'd really worked this out. And that does really come across, you know. It's got the, it deals with some of the aspects of time travel which to some people, you know, don't seem to work out. But Wells was someone who really worked it out in a logical fashion.
Yeah, he really did. And the scene I love, and I've used it a couple times, Nick, was when he was sitting in the time machine looking out his window.
Yeah.
And you could see the seasons changing really fast.
Yep, yeah. And but it's, you know, it's fascinating, the different aspects of time travel. And I mean, another aspect of all of this is a story that simply doesn't go, and I do think there's something to it, is the Philadelphia experiment. The story from the 1940s of a vanishing warship, the USS Eldridge, and which supposedly killed a number of the crew, sent others, ones were sent mad, and the ship was gone. And when the ship came back, some of the crew were dead, others crazy, as I said. And over the years, granted, the story has been changed. The the initial story was that the experiment was to try and make a ship magnetic invisible,
right.
But supposedly it went literally invisible. But then further down the line, we have people come forward who claimed that the warship and the crew actually vanished through time rather than just going invisible. And it's difficult, admittedly, to say, you know, what the truth of the Philadelphia experiment really was.
That's right. Something happened. I mean, they did something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We know that.
Yeah, something really, really weird happened. And it wasn't just one experiment, I don't think. I think it was at least a number. But they still had not got the reins of it, you know. But there's no doubt at all that the Philadelphia experiment was something really weird. And if it was a portion of time travel, the big question would be, well, does this mean an aspect of the government has actually harnessed time travel, possibly even fearful of knowing what to do with it, you know, kind of like the final stages of Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, they put the Ark of the Covenant away for no one to get it because they don't know what to do with it, what the problems could be. Maybe that's actually what government agencies might have done. They may have, you know, if they do have proof of time travel, it may be something that's too fearful to go down that pathway and cause, you know, complete chaos if we start changing time without not knowing what we're really doing, you know.
We had great interviews, Art did and I did, over the years with Al Bielek, who apparently was part of the Philadelphia experiment, and he tells one heck of a story.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was around for a long time, and he was sort of in, like, the second wave, if you like, of people coming forward, you know, with different ideas and on the case. But yeah, I mean, whatever you think of the Philadelphia experiment, number one, something really strange did happen. And we also know that, you know, a number of people have come forward, the case has been expanded. And again, it would not surprise me if, for fear of worrying what we might do and change things.
Exactly. Nick, let's talk a little bit more about time travel and take calls next on Coast to Coast AM.